Thank you for taking a ride on the Freedom Train podcast series. I'm your host, Joseph Ward, and as always, ride with me is my homie, Mr. Patrick Irv. Remember, the Freedom Train is brought to you by PAX, Inc. That's P-A-C-T-S-I-N-C. And PAX, Inc. is a black development organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. As you know, for more information, make sure you visit www.pactsinc.org to learn more about the organization, the codes, how to become a member, how to donate, how to get involved. And if you hover your mouse over the More tab, then they got a Learning Center. If you hover your mouse over that, you'll see all the stuff that they got: audio, politics, Let's Make a Pact book, survival, legal cases, videos, all of that. Just visit www.pactsinc.org. And already, while you're online, visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com so you can learn more about me, my bald spot, Patrick, everybody else that's on the network, all the shows we have, the newest show, the Enigma Sep album, which is our hip-hop show. We're excited about that. The Block and Nickel podcast that we got going on, Lessons from the Screen, the Fix Sports podcast, everything that we got going on right now. And just visit www.freedomtrainradio.com. You know, all the social media platforms at Freedom Train Network, except for Twitter. We're at Freedom Train Net, so you can find us, YouTube, and everything. Pat,
what it?
Tell them about the app.
So we got an app, and right. If you want to know more, go back and listen to one of the old shows, because I'm tired of repeating myself. Look, y'all ain't finna be working my nerves every single time we had this show. We got an app. It's available in the Google Play Store.
Right.
You should go and get it.
Right.
They'll give you access to all of the Freedom Train Network shows and any other messages that we want to give to you. Right there on your phone. It's real small, so you ain't even got to delete none of your pictures. You know what I'm saying? Go to the store, type in Freedom Train Radio. You'll see our logo, the app will come up. Go and get it. Leave us a review and let that be that. If you don't go and get it, I know some homeboys out there on the corner, they're going to come see about you. So how about
that? We're going to drop a diss track on you. Straight up MGK, Eminem style. What you want? How you want it?
Maybe not. I mean, Joe, you picked two white boys.
I'm sorry. That was just the latest beef. I'm sorry. Two black people. Yeah, two black people beef. Diss track like that. There we go. Hey, man, don't be calling me out like that, Pat.
I mean, you know, I do it with all the hate in the world.
I know. Forget you, though. When I see you, I'm going to dunk on you. All right?
What we got? Man.
So today, we got our brother back on the show today, man. So, born in Brooklyn, raised in Queens, a Renaissance man and jack of all trades, right? Graduate of Hampton University with a bachelor's in biology in 2001. Continuing at Hampton, he received his master's in medical science in 2003. Then he furthered his education at Howard, and where he graduated with a doctor of pharmacy in 2007, right? He has published a book of poetry entitled Black Eye on America. He has a regular podcast, and he's a host of a podcast on the Source Radio Network, and that show is called The Pendulum, and you can catch it every Wednesday at 8. He has a number one best-selling album under the Quiet Storm category in Amazon. In 2015, his album is entitled P-O-R-N, because you know the last time it was on, it was talking about that porn, which is poetry, oration, rhythm, narratives, right? He produced an audiobook entitled Speak On It, Mandatory Conversations for Black America, and he's featured as a blogger and a contributor on the Boyce Watkins' Your Black World and Financial Juneteenth. He's been on that, and he has a documentary that he's putting out called Black and Woman, so we had to get him on to talk about not only just the documentary, but a lot of things that he's been doing in the community, a lot of the commentary that he's been having via social media. So once again, welcome my brother back to the Freedom Train Network, our brother, Mr. Dr. Samori Swigert. So get on your feet. Yeah. Welcome back, brother.
Oh, man, thanks for having me once again, man. You know, you and past commentary, man, always face cracking me up, man. I was trying to Make sure I wasn't laughing during the intro. Oh man, I love it.
You know, we can't let Pat out the house sometimes. He'd be crazy.
Hey, that's true. I ain't got no pushback.
So, man, you know how we do. Let's get into this interview so we can get the people down on what Dr. Swagger is going on. So, Pat, you got the first question. Let's do it, man.
All right. Throw me the ball and I'm a dunk it then. Hey, so it's a lot of people out there who they not cool, they not hip, you know, they jive-ass turkeys or whatever, you know.
And
it ain't always their fault, although most of the time it is. I say about 90% of the time it's their fault. But for those people who it ain't their fault, because most of the time it ain't their fault, I say about 90% of the time it ain't their fault, can you give those people a refresher for, you know, who you are, what you do in the community? Joe gave his little list, but, you know, that's cool and all. Whenever Joe say stuff, we don't really take it serious because it's Joe. So, you know, give us the scoop. Let the people know who Dr. Swigert is.
Yeah. I appreciate that, Pat. Well, honestly, I'm just a humble worker, doing the work for the universe, just trying to play my part wherever I can. You know, as Joseph said, you know, as the graduate of Hampton and Howard University, one of the things that I do on the health side is I do pharmacy. So I'm an intensive care unit pharmacist. I work in the ICU, so I provide pharmaceutical care for patients in the ICU in a major hospital in the D.C. area. So that's one of the things. You know, people talk about revolution, and they think that revolution has to be one way. You know, you got to be this militant brother with the AK-47 in the streets with a black beret. And it's like, you know, revolution and effect and positive change comes through a myriad of expressions and manifestations. Mm-hmm. So whether it is somebody that is creating content as far as photography, like Gordon Parks, or movies such as Maryvale Peoples, or whether we're doing poetry or Langston Hughes, Claude McKay, whether, you know, there's a plethora of things that you can put your feet in and walk out your truth. So you know, pharmacy is one of the things where I can make sure that, look, I have these African-American patients that are coming through, and it's my job to make sure that they get thorough understanding of, you know, how to take care of them, how to take care of themselves, and just making sure and overseeing that they're getting the best care possible, at least when I'm on shift. That's one thing. Radio-wise, I work with Source Radio Network, founded by Kathy Lynn. And so they had a myriad and a plethora of hosts that do shows on holistic living, health, cooking, music, spirituality, dating, relationships, things of that nature. So my show is called The Pendulum. And what I do, I call it The Pendulum because, like a pendulum, it swings forward and it swings backward. And so one of the things I like to do is connect the dots from the past and how we are traveling into the future and going back and forth again. So sometimes I'll go into the past where I'll bring up different persons, different events, different dynamics that I think should be discussed in the now, and then how does that project for the future, and what are some future considerations that we should be thinking about and be mindful about as blacks in America right now. And then, like I said, you know, like a lot of blogging and writing. And so that's just a lot of my written commentary, and I just talk about a whole bunch of things. I love being a futurist. I love being a futurist, and we'll talk about that a little later. But some of my things is dealing with the facts that we have now, and then seeing how can we project into the future, how can we forecast into the future where we will be, and how do we play a role in getting there. So that's kind of some things that I do, aside from the writing of the poetry. That's just meant to make sure that I can reach out and touch the souls and the minds of people from different ways. You know, we have different senses, and so poetry is one way of getting, you know, getting information and thoughts to people to share. And also now, you know, doing film, it's another vehicle or medium to impart change.
Right. Now, that's cool, though, that you are thinking outside of the box, because when we are taught about revolution, we are taught about it in, you know, one way, in that manner of we have to always just take up arms. And, you know, that comes from a lack of understanding that when you're taking up arms, usually in that warfare sense, that's the last step because everything else didn't work. So,
exactly.
You know, and it's so like you're saying, because even like art and poetry and writing and things, those help influence the minds of the people who become the revolutionaries and the books and the information. Because if you don't have those, you really don't know why you've been a revolutionary. You're just out there angry for no reason. So it all plays a part that goes into it. So I'm glad you kind of you highlighted that with what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because what I need people to understand is that,
what you mean?
You know, like, that's my uniform. You know, it don't fit you. You know what I'm saying? You know, that's my job to walk out there and be, you know what, Joe?
Yeah,
so, hey, Dr. Swagger, how is your mother doing? We interviewed her. How is she doing?
Oh, man, she's doing well, man. She's doing well. I actually, last week, and I drove her back to Virginia because, you know, they had the big storm, Florence, and so where she was in Virginia, there was a Zone A recommendation from the state, which meant that that was mandatory evacuation because they were in lowlands where, you know, because that's where she is, it's kind of like in the peninsula area where they're surrounded by a lot of water, and so it was mandatory evacuation. So I had to drive down from D.C. to bring her back up here. So, you know, we had some good bonding time just on the road. You know, just chilling when she came back up here, just chilling, talking, watching movies, you know, and then driving her back down last week. And so it was, she's doing well. She's doing well, working on another project. So, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
It's good that she left. I know a lot of people that were in mandatory evacuation zones that didn't leave. So, you know, and some of them suffered pretty bad damage to their homes. No personal damage to themselves, but damage to their homes that could have went really bad. So, you know, matter of fact, that's the first story I've heard of somebody that I know of, at least, that actually left. So, shout out to that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Pat, can I just add something on something that you said about the uniforms and Joseph, what you were saying about the manifestations of revolution.
Sure. I was being silly, so I just stopped because I ain't. But go ahead.
No. You know you're being silly, but in humor is some of the realest things. And when we talk about revolution, and like you said, revolution is on so many different fronts. Uniform. We may think it's a joke, but the KKK, they have a uniform. They have robes. You know, Hitler. When Hitler took over, you know, in Germany, they had their Nazi uniforms, you know, where you had the brown shirts and then you had the different levels where you were inside of the Third Reich, and you had the Thunderbolts and all of that. And you had the swastika. You know, people have uniforms that is part of revolution. It's custom to let you know, even like you think of the Zulu warriors, you know, uniforms and dress, that is all there. Even songs, you know, you would have different war songs, or they had different drum beats and things like that. So music can be used as tools of revolution. You know, all of that. Everything is very, from food, the warriors have to have proper nourishment, you know, in order to be a healthy fighter. You know, if you're not healthy, then you have to be, you're not going to be a good fighter in a war. So when I say revolution comes on so many fronts, it's a circumspect thing. So I just wanted to jump in on that. But yeah,
no,
because right.
But that's, see, true. It's right though. Because if I could channel Patrick for a minute and put Pat to the side, because as really, like, you know, when you say that, there are so many. We could probably have a whole show just on, you know, the way you've just answered that question, or the what you presented in terms of. Everybody has their own lane, and there is no one size fits all. And no, this is revolution. Even when you talk about, like, my son loves reading science fiction novels, and a lot of people, you know, they would consider that junk. But if you think about what that creates in the mind, if you have black science fiction novelists writing these science fiction novels, from a black center perspective in terms of advanced black societies, advanced black technologies and scientists, and how that can empower a kid growing up to say, hey, I saw this in this book, and now I'm going to create that. Or, you know, movies, or you know, songs, and like you said, poetry. All of those things play a role. And so when you start talking about that, now we start talking about the total picture of what it looks like to create a next level society, and the total picture of what it looks like to get there. How do we create these pictures, tell these stories, frame these minds, and shape these perspectives in order to move in that direction? So it's extremely, you know, like, you know, I was bullshitting, but you're 100% on point with what you say. All right, now I'm back to Pat. Joe, I don't like you when you smell like spoiled hamburger meat.
So, not like we said, the last time we had you on the show,
Porn.
You know, our favorite poetry album, Porn. Poetry, Oration, Rhythm, Narrative. So,
Hey, I got a question. I'm sorry, Joe, real quick. I'm sorry, Joe. So, I had this idea. What do you think about this, Dr. Swagger? So,
all right.
The last poetry album was called Porn. The next one could be called Porn Hub.
Right? I got to figure out what the HUB is going to be. But go ahead.
And the license. Man, go on, man.
Go on. You need some help, man. You need some help.
Right. No, but your album went on to be a number one best-selling album under the Quiet Storm category in Amazon. So what did you do to get your album to become a number one bestseller? And, like, what was the overall feeling that you had when you realized that I got the top spot with my album?
So, with Porn, Culturation, Rhythm, Narratives, it was a shock when I first saw it. I was like, wow, you know, like under Amazon's Quiet Storm, the fact that it shot to number one, and it wasn't like any small thing, because it was like you had Boyz II Men were up there in the top 10. You had a Marvin Gaye album that was up there in the top 10. There was Isley Brothers, something up there. And it was just like, wow, you know. So I think that stayed up there for probably about a good week. Then it dropped down to a lower position, maybe like 8. Then it shot back up to number one again. So it was, you know, it was a very elating feeling. I was very happy. I was very proud. How did it happen? I think it was just quality. Just, you know, when you put out quality, people respond. You know, it was. I put a lot of thought into the words and what I was saying and what my mission and objective was, and quality music. So it was like I sourced some of the best musicians I knew, and young musicians, so they had a younger ear, but they were also trained classically from Hampton University's band, Howard University's band, and Norfolk State's band. So when you have that trifecta going for you, and young talent, I didn't expect any less. Now, did my single go, did not my single, but did my album go platinum or gold? No. You know, which is something that you would kind of hope for as an artist. But what touched me was the fact that it was successful, in the fact that it met its objective. How did I know I met that objective? Was from the feedback that I was getting from the people. So when you have people that are emailing you, people that are DMing you, instant messaging you, people that are reposting on Facebook, like, yo, this album is really good. Or when you have friends that they look at, you know, we have friends and associates, and they look at us on a level that they know us on a regular basis. But when you step out of that realm into something different as a musician, you're like, okay, let me see what he's really talking about. And for them to be like, yo, I really did not know that you had this in you. Like, this is really good. and then you know that people are telling you that what you're saying resonates with them, or that it was highly creative, how did you do that? That's when I knew it was successful to me. Objectively, I met my mission, and so that was dope. And it was also it was successful for me because I recouped whatever I spent to get the album done and produced and everything. I got all that back. I still get my monthly checks. So like, you know, sometimes it's $10, sometimes it's $50, you know, but I still have money coming in. So to me, hey, I think that was a success. And thank you, you know, the Freedom Train Radio, PAX Inc., for even having me on the show to talk about it. You definitely played a part. Gray played an instrumental role in that happening, you know. So I definitely take my hat. So I'll clap that up for y'all, too. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Where's the fat man, you know, in the shirt?
See, you set me up, Doc. You ain't even know. You ain't try to do it, but you set me up. Pat was waiting on that.
Because
we got our little hand clap and got Pat. Stop that, Pat. Stop.
I think the fat man should have been fired a long time ago. Dr. Swaggy just gave me more ammo.
That's because you discriminate.
I don't discriminate.
Yeah, man.
Hey, so I got a name.
Ooh.
Poetry on Revolutionary Narratives and Handling Uniform Blackness.
Ooh. Hey, we might be able to use that, man. You might have to go half on that one right there.
The fact that he sat down and thought about that is hilarious.
Hey, it popped in my, I had to think about the hub. The porn part, you know, that's been popping in my head since the show last year, all these years ago.
Something wrong with you.
I ain't never denied it. Never denied it. That's why Pat only come out for this show. Every other time he stay where Bruce Banner keep the Hulk at, that's why I keep Pat at. See, I can't even say his name.
We need Thanos to come around then.
Nah, we good. Are you gonna be releasing any new poetry albums in the future?
I'm pretty sure I will. I already have tracks on deck. I think I have probably about another good 20 tracks with the music and everything on board already. It's just deciding what I really want to talk about. Like, I'm not the type of person to say, let me just put out an album just to put one out and you know, hopefully make some money. Like, I like my, I'm very mindful about what I want to say, what I want to say, and how I want to say it. So when it's right, yes, it's something those definitely will come. The porn hub will come out.
See that? That's networking. Hey, you know what? And me and Joe got an album we've been working on called Ghetto Poetry for Hood Tricks.
Yeah.
What?
Well, yeah, we do. We got like two poems together, and we're going to be performing at local gas stations and chicken joints. So, you know, the food, we got like a 5 food truck tour. So we're going to, you know, look out for, we're going to let you know what city we're going to be in.
Yeah. Well, Joe only got one. I got about 9 or 10 poems now, but I can't release them because then about the album would be unbalanced. So we're waiting for Joe to get his, you know, get his game. But Joe really don't write. Joe more of like a freestyle type person.
So, you know, I just got to get in the booth and just lay him down. So
you know.
Oh, okay. So y'all got like the big boy and Andre 2000 going on up in there.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, we like the way you think.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. That was dope. Yeah. Matter of fact, I'm finna go buy 10 more copies of your album right now.
There it is.
So, your, I did buy your poetry album after you left the show, and I thought it was good. I meant to tell you that, but I never got a chance to.
Thank you, brother. Thank you.
So, you talked about the pendulum. And shout out to Source Radio Network. They are doing what we do, and you know we definitely need more Black voices attempting to do what we both are doing. So shout out to them. So you're over there, and you have the pendulum. Who are some of your most memorable guests, if you can't narrow it down, or if there's somebody that's like easily the most memorable guest, you know, but what, who are the people you remember best as far as being good guests, drop great wisdom on your show?
Oh, man. That's kind of easy. One is a brother that y'all have put me on to. That's Brother Carl Tone Jones.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good brother, man. Met the brother in Philly. Good brother. And, you know, we were talking about his documentary, The Independence Day Project. And I really love that that episode, because it's something that most people don't talk about. We usually talk in terms of, like, excuse me. We usually talk in terms of, like, historical perspective, but mm-hmm. for him to come together with the idea of, look, projecting into the future, how do we survive and thrive as an independent nation? You know what I'm saying? What's required? And just to kind of see him unpack all of that, that was very unique. So that was one of my favorites. Brother Ajay Tayumba, he was on. That was another great episode. Always good wisdom to impart with him. And just all the different ways that he talks about liberation and what can be done. That was another memorable one. And two more. One was with Christopher Everett. He's the filmmaker for Wilmington on Fire, that discussed the burn, the Rosewood type effect that occurred in Wilmington. Now, a lot of people don't talk mm-hmm. about how whites came, and they just not came, but, you know, they were in the city, but they just turned on the whole black population and mm-hmm. committed a genocide, if you will. Mm-hmm. A lot of people talk about that. So just having him give that whole itemized detail of that historical account was very powerful, because I always heard about it, but I never really knew the details. And so for him sharing that, it was a lesson for me. So that was good. And then the last one I would say was Elaine Riddick. I had Elaine Riddick on. She is the founder of the Rebecca Project. Elaine Riddick deals with eugenics. She deals with, she's filed court cases. Matter of fact, so, you know, they had the whole eugenics movement that was popular in the early 1900s and everything like that. North right. Carolina had a state eugenics board, as did a lot of states. But North Carolina had a state eugenics board. She was sterilized under them. She's one of the survivors that was sterilized under that eugenics board. She came back as a grown woman and sued the state of North Carolina and took it up to the Supreme Court and got millions of dollars rewarded to different blacks that were victimized by the state eugenics board, meaning they were sterilized. And just to hear her have her story and her position, it was something powerful. She's actually inside the documentary that I'm working on, because that story really needs to be told for real, for real. So I would say those four were probably the most memorable and impactful for me.
That's a solid lineup. We're familiar with all of them except the last lady you mentioned. But even to that, I'm familiar with that story, mm-hmm. being here from North Carolina. And I did want to say this to, you know, people that might be listening, wanting to look into that North Carolina situation. A lot of those women were sterilized, and they didn't know they were being sterilized.
That's right.
So, you know, that's that, right. And that's something here in the state. I remember 3 or 4 years ago, maybe it was 4 or 5 years ago, here in North Carolina, there was a catch released, like boxes and boxes and boxes filled with documents after documents after documents of all of the women that have been sterilized under that Ooh. Program throughout the life of the program. And a good chunk of them found out that they were sterilized later on in life when they were adults or older and wanted to have a baby and found out that they couldn't.
Uh-huh. Yep. So, and that's how she found out. Yep.
So that story is, every time I hear it, that story impacts me, because I just, you know, like, I don't know. I'm a bit of a softie, but that story definitely gets me a little worked up and infuriated with what they had to go through, what they're still going through. Matt, you know what, Joe? Ask the question, man.
Hey, man. Make you want to swing on somebody, I know. So, Black and Women is the name of your documentary. So, what inspired you to make this documentary? Like, why do you feel like you should be telling these stories that you're telling in the documentary? And can you give people an overall concept of what the documentary is all about?
Yeah, definitely. So, Black and Woman, it's going to be, and here's the thing, it started out to be a documentary. The more and more I started doing more research and conducting the interviews, and just, you know, when you can sit down with somebody like Julianne Malvo and have 5 hours of her time, strictly to you, or a Filet Chione Sue, who's the founder of the Million Woman March, which was the Black Woman's March, not the Pink Hat Woman's March that went up there with Trump. This was the 1997 Black Woman March in Philly. And you can have them for like 5 hours of devoted time, and you hear everything. You're like, you know what? Here's, to try and just make a documentary is a disservice to the story of what Black women had to go through and go through in America. So I had to make the executive decision to say, you know what? No, this is going to be a documentary series. It has to be told and itemized in isolated and dissected issues with specific intention on these different issues. What brought it about, honestly, was just a conversation. It was a happy hour conversation. It was one of my boys' backyards. We all got off work. It was the summertime. We had drinks out in the backyard and everything. So, you know, they had their wives and girlfriends out there. So we're just all chilling talking, but we're talking about interracial dating. And then some of the sisters there was like, you know, they were like, yo, we still don't understand why Black men just, you know, they are always chasing these white women, you know, X, Y, and Z, da, da, da. And when we started picking apart and doing the analysis, you know, I offered my two cents, and it registered with a lot of them. But then I had to go back. When I went back home, it still stayed on my mind. Like, damn, you know, what this was, why is it? And then, you know, I started realizing, like, well, you know, The white woman is paraded and showcased on all levels of society that Black women are not. And this starts at a very young age. So I'll give you a little something, because this, what I'll give you right here is just from one episode that I'm working on. And this one is, I'm dealing with propaganda, right? And that's this. From a young age, you ask why Black men, or some Black men, seem to always kind of migrate or navigate to dating white women. Because we've been groomed, we've been trained since we were little. From stories of Cinderella, Snow White, right, you know, from the video games we played, Legend of Zelda, we played Mario Brothers. Who were you? When you play Mario Brothers, who were you fighting and killing for? You were killing creatures and all that to save the princess. Who was the princess? It was a white woman. When we played, Double Dragon, you were killing people in the street to rescue this white girlfriend, you know, from Olive Oil and Popeye. The white woman is to be, you are to fight over her. From King Kong, as, you know, save this white woman from the bestial aspects of some creature or some man. From the comics, what we're talking about, She-Ra, you know, whether we're talking about Small Wonder, whether we're talking about I Dream of Jeannie, whether we're talking about, oh man, I could go in, Vanna White from Wheel of Fortune.
No, you're right.
From, I can go on and on. I don't have my list in front of me, like, because when you put the documentary together, you have, you know, you got to compile everything. And when I say I have, like, pages of stuff, the white woman has always been paraded. From G.I. Jane, okay? From Pretty Woman with Richard Gere. What message is that sending? Oh, a white woman can be a hoe. She could be a prostitute. She could be a slut and still walk away with a wealthy white man and upgrade herself in society because of that. You have seen no black woman, nothing like that, being no Cinderella story for a black woman on that level. You know what I'm saying? Nothing of the sort. And so it, when they sell cars, it has always been something with a white woman there, you know. And so as you grow and as a child, even let's look at this way too. From pornography, when, you know, when you're young and, you know, your uncle or your daddy's had a little Hustler and Playboy magazines, and it's mostly been white women that you would sneak and then you flip through there the pages, you know, and yeah, it was mostly white women. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
From That's Miss true. America. Miss America pageant started in 1932 or early 1930s. The very first black woman to even be considered Miss America was Vanessa Williams. And that was in like 1983, 85. So you can tell me for over five decades, no black woman is worthy of Miss America. But black women have been the backbone of this country. So it shows you, you know, the manifestation of what's supposed to be beauty. And so then it becomes ingrained and instilled and encoded in the black men's psyche in front of all male psyche. I'm going to say black men, but all male psyche, that the white woman is the prize because that's what has always been paraded and showcased for you. You've never seen black women in that capacity. You've never been indoctrinated and brainwashed that the black woman should be regarded at that level of beauty, that level of prestige, that level of honor. It is a conditioning. So that's just some of it, what I'm talking about.
Nah, but that's true, though. I like how you're breaking that down because it needs to be broken down. It needs to be understood because from a very young age, unconsciously, or in some cases consciously, depending on the environment you grew up in, the white woman is the goal. The white woman is the treasure. The white woman is seen as something that you need to have to in order to be somebody. And, you know, I know a lot of times, Pat and I on here, we do our best to crush those off myths. So, you know, most people think that when successful black men get out there that most of them marry white women, which is the narrative that they want to sell because, you know, 85% of successful black men usually marry black women. But just that, even that 15% is put out there so much as if this is the glory, this is it. If you don't have no white women, then you're not talking about nothing. So that's why I'm glad you're putting it out there. And I'm also glad that we're starting to have these things via social media that is showing that, you know, black families do exist. Black men do like black women. Black men do cherish black women because we want black women to understand that. But we also need to understand why black men feel the need to date white women. And it's just like on my sports podcast, we're talking about with Serena Williams. Like, no matter how much white men step on her, at the end of the day, she still chose a white dude. So, you know, and she chose what she wanted to choose. But hey, we still recognize the things that is happening. So I'm glad that's being broke down.
Let me, because as you were talking, and you were definitely dropping the jewels, I had to pull up my table from the documentary. Just so I'm going to run it down for y'all real quick, just so people get the enormity of what I'm saying. So, from cartoons, you had the Flintstones. Was there ever any black character in the Flintstones?
Nope.
No. The Jetsons, which is into the future, were there ever any black characters in the Jetsons?
Nope.
No. In the Smurfs, which were even, weren't humans, but what did they do? How did you know that the only woman of the Smurfs was a white woman, how did you know? She had fucking blonde hair. Hair, right? From She-Ra to Princess Leia, the Queen Amidala, to the cartoon Jem, Wonder Woman, Barbie, Betty Boop, Tinkerbell, Little Mermaid, Miss Piggy, Carmen Sandiego, Powerpuff Girls, Josie and the Pussycat, all right? And we're talking about Tomb Raider, okay? If we're talking about Donkey Kong in the video games, if we're talking about Paula Deen, Rachel Ray, Dukes of Hazzard, Hannah Montana, The Bionic Woman, Xena, Charlie's Angels, Sex in the City, Bewitched, Desperate Housewives, all right? Alice in Wonderland. What are we talking about? Roger Rabbit, Jessica. You know what I'm saying? The Stepford Wives. It goes so deep into how white women should be always considered as a factor, even if it's in prominence or the victim, whether we're talking about victims in the ID channel or forensic files. So we're talking about, you know, your the white women that go missing, that get abducted, all of that. This stuff is subconscious, and it is a true propaganda because you don't see black women positioned in those in the equal distribution of content material. It is propaganda.
That's true.
Most definitely. I want to set that up because I know a lot of people are going to be like, yeah, but black men do pick. And here's the deal. Like, what you're saying is accurate. And it's accurate on all levels, and it's true on all levels, because even though we can say the majority of black men do date black women, marry black women, the fact of the matter remains that in comparison to other groups, our numbers are exponentially higher. So that speaks to this undercurrent, this guide, this picture, this formulation, this whatever you want to call it, that's present within black men, that we have this drive towards white women. So the majority of us are dating black women, but when you compare it, we're 2 times more likely than black women are to date white men. And then we're exponentially more likely than anybody, white or, you know, white men or white women. They're both at, I believe the number is either right around 1% or less than 1%. So, you know, when you start looking at it from that perspective of, you know, 8 to 10% of black men are dating outside of their race versus 4 to 6% of black women versus 1% or less of white men or white women versus 1% of less of Asians versus 2% or less of Hispanics. When you start looking at those numbers, you begin to see the grand scope of what people are saying. And even to that, Me and my wife used to do this when we would ride around town or watch TV or whatever. We would like count the black couples in advertisement and on television. And you could never see them. Every time, I know me in particular, I went a whole week doing this. Every time I saw a black man, he was with a white woman. And every time I saw a black woman, she was with a white man. And this was every single time. When it came to advertisements, billboards, you see black couples on billboards now, but at the time,
they're pushing that hard in the media. They're pushing that interracial couples hard.
Interracial couples were everywhere when it came to being on TV, when it came to, and it was even, and then we talk about, like, where does that stigma even come from in terms of rich black men always end up with white women? That's because that's all they show you. You're not paying attention to the Denzel Washingtons. How often do you really get to see him with his wife compared to, you know, some old white dude? But then there's also the shock and awe factor and all this other stuff. You pay more attention to things, to the blah. So, you know, I get all that, but I just wanted to say that, to say, you know, you make a very, very, very valid and powerful point when you start talking about the power of propaganda, especially with it when it relates to children's programming.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't even know what they're getting. And then they grow up with this line of thought, and they think it's just, well, that's just what I do. That's just how I always been. There ain't nothing wrong with it. No, bro, that, you don't even realize.
He's programmed.
Right.
Yeah, nah, Yeah, what's interesting though is that because that program has to be countered. So as you're saying, I was just thinking about like my daddy, like he was adamant, don't bring no white girl home. Even though it's like I'm thinking about April O'Neil in the old Ninja Turtle cartoons in that yellow suit. You know, the little one-piece suit and how we would look at her and lust and the different white women we would lust over growing up. But then my daddy...
wrong with that one, bro. I ain't never think April O'Neil was hot.
Hey, man, so what? I ain't saying that many we was kids, okay? But now we're grown, we know better. All right, it's Nia Long and Angela Bassett now, okay?
That's right.
But you know, my daddy was like, hey, white women are trouble. Don't bring no white women home. He never really explained it until we got older. But now, you know, it helps. So that stuff needs to be counted. If it's not counted, then you're going to have more and more black men feeling that white women are a better option than black women when that's not the case.
That's right. That's right. Yes, sir.
I explain it every chance I get. Look, I'll be honest. I know I probably get in trouble if we blow up later and somebody go back 10 years from now and listen to this podcast. So this is for you. But I'm being honest. Like, white women scare me more than white men do, because every single time there's mass genocide, or not genocide, but every single time there's mass destruction in the black community, it boils down to a white woman. Like, that is scary to me. You look at Wilmington, 1898, you look at Tulsa, you look at Rosewood. You go through all these examples. It always boils down to a white man defending some white lady. Whether or not she lied is irrelevant. She needs to be defended, and he going to do that. And he don't care if he got to burn the entire black section of town to the ground. That is scary. And they're so good. They've attained elite status at weaponizing their femininity. And
that's right.
Weaponizing the white male's desire to defend the white woman. I can't even be mad at the white man, because that's what we supposed to be doing for all women.
That's correct.
Right. You. Right.
Man, white
that's
women
correct.
Scare me, bro. When I see them coming, I cross the street.
You know, listen, you shouldn't be afraid of if somebody was listening to this later on. The thing is, when you speak truth, you speak truth. Those incidents actually occurred in Tulsa, in Wilmington, in Rosewood. Central Park Jarger case happened, okay? Down to current day, presently, where we're trying to rationalize the justification and the innocence of this white woman officer, Geiger, that shot and killed Botham Jean in his own apartment, who's minding his business, but yet you're still trying to make it seem as though he was doing something wrong. He didn't obey her commands in his damn apartment. You know, he must have had some marijuana, so something wrong with him. No. How are you quick to defend somebody that was completely in the wrong?
Right. But like you said, white women have been placed into this classified super protective category by white men, rightfully so. And they understand that, and they use that to their advantage to get what they want. Because, you know, when white women don't get what they want, and they use that whiteness and that womanness, and usually somebody black get hurt after that. So,
well, we could take it to one more level. We could talk about, the thing now is Barbecue Becky, where the story where it shows you how white women are weaponizing, like Pat said, are weaponizing their whiteness and their femininity to express and exercise and exert power and authority, where they're just calling police on black people just because they feel like somebody is not complying or acquiescing and kowtowing to their demands, or where they feel somebody should be or not doing what she feels they should do. And so they know that they're not just calling the police. They're calling an actual hit on a black person, because we've seen most of these encounters with police usually result in the fatal results. And so they are really, really weaponizing that. And so we have to be keen and aware of this. Yes.
And I think one of the most powerful examples, outside of all of the ones that have been listed, to the power and influence of white women, is the fact that we had prohibition in America. A lot of people don't realize that whole outlawing of alcohol was driven by white women, and they ain't even had a right to vote.
Right.
The outlawing of drugs was driven by what the white men.
Talk to me about power. Talk to me about influencing white men to give up something that they are in love with, probably even more than white women, without having any political power whatsoever. Yeah, hey, bro, that's power right there.
Ooh, right.
Facts.
Man, look here. So enough about these white women. In your opinion, why are black women so special, and what could we do to not continue to overlook our own women?
Black women are special because black women are the backbone of America. Like I said, you know, black women, first of all, they are the carriers of genetic material. Both men, black men and black women carry genetic material. But we need the black women to carry that genetic seed. You know, we cannot survive as a black nation without the black woman, right?
Right.
To talk about it from a historical perspective, they've cooked, they've cleaned, they've been in the fields, they've labored. Their sexual reproductive system has been exploited as the manufacturing plant for slave masters to increase the slave population. That's when they had the slave bullpens, where it was just the whole purpose, have more sex. See if you can get two births within 16 months, whereas, right, you know, you only were supposed to undergo 9 months of labor. You know, see if you can squeeze out more slaves, because we had the transatlantic slave trade, but then it got outlawed. So then you couldn't really import slaves. So then slave masters had to increase the breeding of slaves. And how they do that? By forcing more sexual engagement and encounters to occur, so black women could give birth to more black babies, which would in turn be slaves for the slave plantation. There are unsung heroes behind all the movements and the marches. They are the ones that have the, whether they were cooking meals, providing housing, providing ideas, whether putting themselves in a position where at a quick instant they have to think this is a woman before she's black. You know, of course, we know that didn't hold up after a while. There are the children and the babies typically spend the first 5 years of their life, mostly with the mother, and the mother implants and codes and sets that child for life, what they're supposed to do, you know, help them trying to figure out who they are, but just give them, set them right, you know, set them right. Like, that is what they have done. And so black women are special. If we think that we can survive as a race without them, you're sadly mistaken. And so it's up to us to make sure that they are protected. When you kill black women, like I was interviewing Abiodun Oyewole of The Last Poets, and he said, when you kill a woman, you're not just killing a person. He said, you are killing a whole community, because life comes from the woman. So when you start killing women, you're killing the whole nation in itself. And that's true. And so we have to be protective of that. So as we see these Sandra Bland's, things like this happening, and just vigilante white male rage, where the brother went up to the sisters in California on the train and just stabbed her to death, you know, it's an assault on our nation. It's assault on black women, but it's an assault on our nationhood, and it has to be taken seriously. And the thing is, they face two dynamics. You know, they're black, meaning one in America, the way America has set up their totem pole hierarchy of power based on wealth and race. They're black, so they're at the bottom, and they're women, whether we'll look at it on a patriarchal side, because some may say, well, you get into patriarchy and feminist stuff. Like, look, You can say what you want, but until we have Barack Obama, who's running? Who's all the presidents? White men. You know what I'm saying? They set policy standards, and they adhere to a strict code of that. So they're black and women. And so their stories have to be told, because oftentimes they're marginalized, they're ignored, their stories are erased, they go unsung and unrecognized. And so that is something that must be spoken to.
Yes,
you
sir.
Know, when you say that, it reminds me of, I forget the lady's name, but you know, there's a black woman that coined the term intersectionality. You know, and so, and I was reading up on her, and I forget her name, but I think she was involved in the case where the Justice Department in America, I believe it was during a time where somewhere out west, factory workers had just started coming in the 70s, and black women had been hired.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were having financial issues, and they started laying the women off, and they took it to court saying that what the company is doing is both sexist and racist. And mm-hmm. she tried to use the term intersectionality to show that these women were negatively affected by this first fire or last hire first fire rule on account of they were both women and black. And when you said black and women, it made me think about that, because the judge actually threw the case out and told them that they had to pick one or the other. They had to be the black or women. They couldn't be a double minority.
So, when you're born a quadruple minority,
right? But it's just funny, because when you use that, when Joe first told me about your documentary, that was the very first thing I thought about, was that case in the 70s where, you know, these women were told, nah, baby, you got to pick one. You can't be a black and a woman. You got to either be black or a woman. And then it made me think about a lot of the other reading I was doing, where women are, you know, I'm sure you've heard it where they say to be a woman is to be white and to be black is to be a man. So the black woman is ignored because she's not white and she's not a man.
Right.
So I think about that. But then I wanted to ask you, because I was wondering, we're always talking about our warrior class here in America in particular. Our young men that are the gangsters on the street, our warrior class occurred in the some. You know, our warrior class has been feminized according to others. I've been leaning towards for the last few years, maybe a little bit longer, that black women are a significant part of our warrior class that we're just refusing to recognize. What do you think about that?
I definitely believe that you have a very valid point, and it's real. And the thing is, throughout history, we've seen the gallant efforts and participation of so many black women. Whether we want to go into the Panthers, that we had sisters in there that were ready to put in work and were putting in work. From Kathleen Cleaver, we know about Angela Davis, we know about Sister Asada. We can go to Sister Harriet. We can talk about Yah Santiwa. There are a lot of sisters, Barbara Sizemore, many.
The Warriors of Dahomey. Well, that's the right. Back a little bit further.
Yes. So, yeah, I don't think we do enough acknowledging, and we have to rethink about, is warrior just a male-dominated thing? I know we want to protect our women, we don't want to endanger them, but at the same time, we cannot factor them out as being probably one of the strongest allies and only ally, really, in
right.
this race for liberation. You know, like, that is our only ally. And even in chess, the queen is the strongest position.
A powerful analogy.
On board.
Right,
now, that's true, though. I mean, you know, and Pat and I, we've had this conversation. Our women have always been a part of those same classes as men. Black women have always been seen as equal, you know, comes from the God and the God is concept. So there was no, like, men dominate women. It was a balance. That's how you had the concept of Maat. You have to have balance. So you got to have men and women on the same level. But you know, that warrior class, women, I've said that the westernized woman has been thought of as the one who needs to constantly be protected, the one who can't handle herself, the one who's the weak one in the group, the one who's the dainty one, the damsel in distress waiting to be saved. But that African woman, even though she's been nurtured, she's been put up on a pedestal, she's been loved, she's going to get all those nurturing traits. But when it comes to kick ass, she kick your ass. So
and she will put that work.
Right.
What's funny about that, and I do agree, and I do think black men are protected by black women, and black women are protected by black men. That's that yin and yang circle of life, blah, blah, blah. We protect each other. But what's interesting is when you go down the psychological rabbit hole of Dr. Swagger, when you talked earlier about the propaganda of the damsel in distress, the white women, and the impact that that has on black men. But, you know, when we begin to think about the impact that has on black women and how they begin to see themselves and how they begin to want to be treated similarly to, not in all cases, just theoretically here, how they begin to maybe want to be treated in the same way that white women are, but how that might not necessarily agree with their evolutionary disposition, their genetic disposition is being warriors, being women that have been willing to pick up a spear and jab your ass in the throat if you get too close to a goddamn kid. So something like that, you know what I'm saying? Dealing with that dynamic of, on the one hand, in this culture, in this society, we love the dainty woman that needs to be protected, needs to be defended, needs to be this, that, and the third. On the other hand, I got this genetic predisposition that makes me want to karate chop your ass in the throat for getting too motherfucking close to me. Like, do we ever really have conversations about how those two things could potentially, if they exist and if we accept the existence of them both, could potentially create a conflict within the psyche of black women in America?
You mean like they create a conflict as far as wanting to pursue the traditional dainty, subscribe to the traditional daintiness that white women are afforded versus...
Right, like in American society, I know I need to be this if I want to be considered desirable. I know I need to be submissive. I need to be... You know, I need to be a damsel in distress. I need to be rescued, or at least appear to be rescuable. I want to be rescued. But I don't like doing none of that stuff. Like, I don't have urges to be that woman. Mm-hmm. But I do want to start a family. I do want to get married. I do want to do this. I do want to do that. So for me to do these things that biologically I want to do in terms of spreading my seed, propagating my genetics and blah, 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 I have to be something that's really not within me to be. And that could potentially create a conflict.
I think that does occur. And I think goes to, one is respect and care is what our women want and what they need. Respect and care. We have to make sure that as men, we are affording them that, and we are giving them that respect and care. At the same time, they want the autonomy and the right to determine what they want in life as an individual. And so that has always kind of been the traditional argument when it comes to womanism. Like, white women always use the term feminism. Black women have really more so migrated under the banner of womanism, because it's a different, they have defined, it's a different, when we talk women's liberation, there's a dividing line, because a white woman's liberation is completely different from a black woman's definition of liberation.
Right.
Who are they liberating themselves from, and where are they going? Who are the powers that be that are controlling? Are two totally different dynamics. So a lot of black women and Empress Chi, who's one of the contributors in the film, does a great, excellent breakdown that specifically shows the dividing line and demarcation between white women's liberation versus what may be considered black women's liberation. I think it revolves around respect and care, and then the autonomy and right to determine what they want.
Okay.
That's true. That's true. So you named a couple of the women who were in the documentary. Could you give us a couple more names of some of the people, like notable names that people would kind of know of, and just some of the impactful ones? But why did you choose some of these specific women to be in this documentary?
Right. So carefully thinking, like I said, I was trying to make sure that most of the issues are individually addressed as opposed to just a two-hour documentary that tap dances on a few issues. And so I wanted to make sure that I had some names that people know or some individuals that I know that have right. some very good things to offer that you will right. get to know. One was Derica and Natalie Wilson. They are the founders of Black and Missing Foundation. These are the two sisters that are going around and using audio resources to find our missing black children, you know,
right.
Missing boys, missing black boys, missing black girls, missing, you know, adults. But that's what they do, and it's specifically geared toward our community. And so that comes to be, the reason I chose them is because as we talk about all these different missing black girls that are occurring all throughout the country, we got to speak to that because that's important. We've always seen that when white girls go missing, they get all the media coverage and all the attention. And any missing person, and the thing is, I'm not going to get on a race bag specifically, but what I'm saying is any person that goes missing deserves attention. But what you see is that white girls and white children, they get more attention than when black children and specifically black girls go missing. You don't hear that. And so this is why you have names after, you know, Amber Alert, Jessica's Law, you know, things like that. It's, you know, mostly they're named after white girls. You know, you don't have, I think Jess may have made a law named after a black girl. So that's that. We have Dr. Chantella Sherman. She specializes in eugenics and study of eugenics and how it has been injurious to black women. So we have a whole eugenics episode. Elaine Riddick, who says the Rebecca Project, that also talks about sterilization and eugenics. Dr. Julianne Malveau, an economist, well-known, well-renowned economist from MIT. She's also been the university president of what's the name of that? It's HBCU, but it's for black women.
It was Dillard. Was it Dillard?
Benedict.
Yeah, Benedict. There you go.
Yep. She was the president of that. So that, you know, to me, that spoke volumes. We could talk about economy, finance, and then the education of black women. Had to have her. Empress Philae Chione Sue, who was the founder of the Million Woman March back in Philly. In 1997, still doing her work right now to this day, and just talks about the real idea of liberation and the concept of black women. And the thing is, I like her specifically because she talks about the autonomy and the determinism of black women and the needs of black women and the issue of black women. But at the same time, she ingratiates and embraces the whole concept of family. Like sometimes you have this division where it's kind of like black men are etched out of the family concept or as if we're not needed. But she embraces the whole concept of, you know, black man and black woman together to, you know, bring a family up. But at the same time, recognizing that there are issues that black women go through and they need addressed. So it had Empress Philae Chione Sue. Vashti Dubois, she is the CEO of the Color Girls Museum in Philly. So she has a whole museum dedicated to black women and the care of black women and just the whole timeline of what black women have gone through. So I was like, you know, that's dope. When you have a whole museum dedicated to black women, like, yeah, we got to talk about that. The Listening Tree books, they're going to be, that's a husband and wife team, Kimberly and Omar Finley. And this goes back to what Patrick was saying. They have a whole bookstore that is specifically geared towards black books, and their child-centric books, and it's all about empowering black children and having them think into the future. You know, so all the books are Afrofuturistic. It expands the whole what-if conversation of black children and what you can be and investing in their potential. So they're in there because we have to have, the same way we said there's propaganda with cartoons, video games, comic books, and all that, this is why you need the Listening Tree books and what they have to offer. Dr. Satira Streeter, she's a psychologist. So she's going to be blending the conversation towards different trauma and psychological trauma that black women go through and don't even know that they have, unbeknownst to them. I have Anthony Browder from the Hidden Colors series. Dr. Wilma Leon from SiriusXM, like I said, Abiodun and Oyewole from The Last Poets is in there. Ranisha Franklin, she's one of my friends and sorors. She's a photographer, but she goes into, just under photography, how people interpret beauty and what they see and how photography can be used as a tool to empower, like, and restore black women's image. And so we go on things like that. These are the people that I have in the film, and you know why I chose them.
Yeah, that's cool, and that's a good lineup too. That's a nice lineup. I know I've been doing my best to reach out to the young ladies from Black and Missing because we want to get them on here and talk about the organization and things. So that's definitely a nice lineup that you got going on.
Thank you.
I like the fact that it's a docuseries. I know we talked about that with Professor Carlton Jones' project, the Independence Day project, and I think he's still going to do it, but I like that model for our projects and the things we got going on, because like you said, the topics are so deep, and there's so much material to cover, it's hard to hit it all in a two-hour documentary, and an 8 or 10 hour thing, like some of these super long documentaries, it's just, like, ain't nobody gonna watch that. So I like the fact that you're going the docuseries route. I really think more people need to follow that model.
Yep, definitely. Thank you, bro.
Oh, is my turn to ask a question?
And you usually is, but you know.
Well, I mean, I have been asking so many questions because you know. Like, here's the deal, right, for everybody. I like conversational type interviews where we just talk and shoot the shit and ideas bounce. And y'all be all on this, nah, man, ask a question type thing. So when y'all hear these spaces like that, that's usually what's going on. I'm trying to push back, and he like, fuck you, Pat, ask a question. So that's usually what's happening.
Joe about to slam dunk on you again.
So jump together, Pat.
See, it just happened again. Go ahead.
So as far as making the documentary, because you have a docuseries, but just go, what goes into producing a documentary? And as far as your project now, how much time have you put into it to making it as far as you have with the documentary?
Oh, that's a good question. I tell you, it is definitely a monumental task, especially when you're like the main, when you're the videographer, the interviewer, you're doing the lighting, you're doing the reaching out to the different cast contributors. So you're doing the emails, you're doing the phone call. Reaching out to them, you know, you're driving, I'm driving down to Atlanta on my weekends and then got me back to work on Monday to get an interview, driving up to Philly on the weekend, just to drive back to D.C. to get the interview. So the time is there, the money, you need to have your money aside because whether you're paying for transportation and in gas, insurance for equipment, video cameras, lighting, film cards, different editing software packages. There's a budget that you need to have for that. You don't want just a straight interview where it's just people, but you kind of want to have footage. You want to have photos to go along as you're talking. So you need licensing to get certain photos and certain video footage clips. So, you have to have money set aside for getting that. And then people have to understand that, once you film all this, you get all this great footage, you then have to index your, this is what I do. I index my video. What I mean by that is, I get me like a marble notebook, and you have to itemize it. So if I'm editing everything that from, let's say, when I interview Dr. Juliana Malvo, I'll go to a page in the marble notebook, I'll set up my columns, and then it's like, for each video clip, there's like a little a number that your camera will give you for that file. So it's like file 9026. So I'll write down Julianne Malvo 9026. And then I'll do the starting time. So the time that she starts to the time that she ends on a specific segment that we're talking. So she's talking about Black women's liberation from the 2 minute mark to the 7 minute and 36 second mark. I'll write that down and I index that and I write the, what the topic is. But that gives me a database. It gives me an index on whatever I want to look for when I'm going through, because, I have all these different speakers and you're talking about 5 hours of film. I can easily go to the topic that I want for that specific speaker and I know where in the time frame, because I wrote down the time frame that they were talking about it, I can go specifically to that file, to that specific time, and just chop and cut exactly what I want to put it where I want it in the film. So, I call that indexing your film. That takes a while. It takes a long time because you have to go through everything that you recorded. So if I've recorded Dr. Julianne Malvo for 5 hours, I have to watch it again for 5 hours. And as I'm watching, I'm indexing. And itemizing it. So that takes a while. But once you have it indexed, once you have all your stuff indexed, it's just fun. That's just, okay, what do I want to talk about here? Okay, let me get this from this clip. Let me get this from this clip. Let me get that. Okay, let me get this photo that I got the licensing for here. I want to put that here. Let me get this video clip and insert it here. Let me go ahead and put this visual effect here. That's when it all comes into play, but that takes a while. And so, right now what we're trying to do, my brother and I, is trying to work on it and decide distribution-wise how we want to do it. We were thinking about, we can do the DVDs, but I'm like, I kind of want to steer away from the DVDs now. I may do a few, but, once you start getting the DVDs nowadays, people just start bootlegging your stuff, and I kind of don't necessarily want that. As much as I want it, as much as this is a labor of love and I want everybody to know at the same time, I do want it to be profitable because that was time, energy, and money that went into constructing it. Exactly. So deciding if we want to do this as like something where we would shoot it to Netflix or Amazon Prime or Vimeo. Or we have a very unique thing that my brother and I have been working on. And that's something that we're trying to partner up with the HBCUs on a whole another angle that people haven't thought about yet. So I ain't going to let the cat out the bag on that. But once we get the distribution inked well, I'll let you know. We come back on it. But it's a unique strategy. I think that'll be very new and beneficial. So yeah,
the DVD route is limited now anyways, because most people don't have
the stream. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're streaming all this. The other thing you have to worry about of going digital though is piracy.
That's right. That's the other thing too. Right.
So, you know, that whole pirated movie market is huge.
It's huge, exactly. And that's what I'm saying, like, you know, Netflix and Amazon, as much as you kind of want to be in complete control, that's kind of like maybe one of only the few ways you can really control it. Like, you're not going to be able to really, you got to be very ingenuitive and know how to, like, rip that stuff from their database, you know.
And Amazon contracts, you get paid up front anyways, right? Like, there is no pay per view.
Well, they do. So there's a, what's it called? Amazon Direct, I believe. They can pay up front, but there's also something where they were talking about some streaming per view also. I have to go back and look at the documents that I was reading. But it's two ways that I think you can get it.
Yeah, I think I meant to say Netflix. I knew Amazon had a pay per thing. I meant Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix. They doing it big up front.
It's rape.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when will the project be available for people to get in? How can people contact you to support you? To donate money to help the documentary do what it needs to do.
Right. So the very first episode, I'm trying to squeeze the first two, but the first episode, trying to have that complete by mid-November, and that should be like all done, like finalized. The way people could reach me is blackandwoman@gmail.com. That's like the email address that you can contact and, you know, just stay in contact with us with what we're doing. So that's blackandwoman@gmail.com. They can go to, I'm about to upload some more content to the Facebook fan page, Black and Woman, on Facebook, and I'll shoot that over to you guys. So you know if you want to share it, you can go ahead and put that there. So it's a Facebook page, Black and Woman. I put the trail up on there also. Actually, I put one of your articles of the Black Women Warriors. It was an article that you did. I believe it was about the Black Women Warriors. It was something about Black women that you had did. I actually posted it on there too.
Okay.
Because I also want to be like an empowerment page for people, specifically Black women. And if they want, they can also hit me on Facebook, and that's Samori Swigert, Samori. Last name is Swigert, Swygert. And also, the big thing is right now is we're having the campaign. It's an ongoing campaign. It is on GoFundMe. So you can just type in Samori, Samori, Swigert, Swygert, on GoFundMe. And you'll see it's a fundraiser for Black and Woman documentary film series campaign. You might be able to type in Black and Woman and it'll come up. But if you definitely type in Samori Swigert on GoFundMe, it'll come up there. So you can always, and you can make donations there. So far, we're doing pretty well. I'm very thankful for all the donations. I thank you, too, for making a donation, brother. I think right now, like $2,035, which is good. I'm grateful for everything. If people donate a dollar, I'm thankful for everything. That's where it's at.
Very, very, very needed documentary for our culture, for the people, for the generations, especially the future generations, but the older generations as well, because we have to really get back to understanding why we need to continue to or place Black women back on the pedestal, but also that us as men need to understand the part that we play into making sure that competent, whole women who love themselves are created and being out in this society, because I hate when I see like a post on social media where you have men slamming the black women for the way that the children are, but and then you can't make a child and not raise your child, so you can't just put it all on black women to make right. society better and just excuse the black dudes because you just want to excuse them. So it takes both. So the
feminists right.
definitely need it. So.
Exactly.
So we're down to our final question, and you know this is Pat's question. We all know Pat's special. So I'm going to go ahead and set up his question like this and make it happen.
Hamburger. hey, matter of fact, so I'm gonna do something a little different because I'm special.
No.
Hold on.
Different, you trip, but you're gonna do different. Oh,
that's because it's my shit.
Whatever.
Excuse the language, parents, but the show is rated NC-17 according to Google. So, Dr. Swagger, the last time we interviewed you on December 6, 2016, you said that if you were the president, all-powerful, all-ruler, czar, god, deity of black America, you would remove the spirit of competition between black people and replace it with cooperation and camaraderie. We are asking you the same question here on this 23rd of September 2018. What would you do? What would your message to the people be if you were the all-powerful ruler, God, deities are of black America?
Great question, and I like that 2016 answer. I'll keep that answer the same. And I'll add that black America, don't be afraid to learn and embrace your culture and your history. I think, you know, now a lot of people, they act like they're ashamed to learn about our culture and our history. You know, you even see people shaming people that are doing research. Oh, I don't want to hear about that. Oh, you hotepping. Oh, you know, we in the 21st century. Look, man, embrace your history. You know, white America is not afraid or ashamed to embrace their history. This is why Kaepernick is going through what he's going through, because they're sticking to the tradition of white history. So learn it, embrace it, and love it. I would say take regular inventory of yourself, and that means like weekly, or whenever you get a chance, I'll say at least weekly, and find out what are the negatives that are inside of you and purge that. Eliminate the negatives, whether it's negative self-talk, whether it is, you know, how you perceive your fellow brother, your fellow sister, whether it's laziness, whether it is just greed, like, you know, whatever that is a negative trait or characteristic, once you've located that from your inventory, eliminate that and purge it. And at the same time, whatever strengths, skills, talents, and passion you may have, build on that. So building and destroying, definitely. I would say we have to embody proper terminology as we deal with each other's blacks. And I mean, it's the simplest thing. I think if we said please more, thank you more, sorry more, and excuse me more, so much of the stuff that goes on wouldn't even go on, man. So we just, and we say more please, more thank you, more sorry, more excuse me, amongst our, the way we deal with each other, we would definitely be a lot further. I would encourage people to become futurists, like I said, because too many of us are stuck in a complacent mode. You know, we're stuck in the pleasures of now, and the future is the manifestation of the execution of thought. The future is the manifestation of the execution of thought. So we have to think, we have to dream, we have to plan and execute, or we'll be slaves to the thoughts and creations of others. So we have to be futurists. And I say lastly, come back to building home again. We have to rebuild home.
home is being shattered, fractured, and disintegrated, and we have to rebuild home.
Yes, sir.
Well, good brother, if you will please excuse me, sorry that we got to cut this interview off short, but thank you for joining us. See what I did there?
What?
See what I did?
No.
Joe,
he said, please, slow, Joe. Thank you. Sorry, excuse me.
He said, say, please, thank you, sorry, and excuse me.
I'm not caught that. I just wanted to ruin your time. That's it.
You know what, Joe? go make you some cornflakes. I pissed in them.
There you go. There you go. I'll make sure I feed them to somebody's teacher. So there it is. Man, we definitely appreciate you coming on the train with us and telling us more about Black and Women, the docuseries, as well as the things that you got going on. And definitely want to make sure we continue to support you, continue to help spread your message and everything that you got going on. Y'all make sure y'all check out Source Radio Network every Wednesday at 8 p.m. because you're on YouTube, right?
Yeah, we do YouTube too also. Yep.
Right. Yep. So Source Radio Network, Google it. You can definitely check out the whole network. They got a whole bunch of good shows on there, but definitely support the brothers more. And make sure you support the documentary. And if you don't, we're going to come looking for you. That's just how it is.
And I say also, continue to support PAX Inc. and Freedom Train Radio. And thank you for making this an abode for me. So I definitely thank you, brothers, for that.
No problem, my brother. No problem. And we ain't gonna hold you up no longer. But definitely talk to you later.
All right, y'all brothers, take care.
Yes, sir.
All right, peace.
Yes, sir. Pat.
With it.
I heard you trying to be a Ruben Studdard backup singer.
Nah, man, I was trying to take over because I seen better.
This is my sorry for 2004.
Dang, it's been that long since that song came out.
I know, right? Oh, Big Rude, what happened to Big Rude?
Man, I guess he got stuck in
2004. I guess so. Man, you already know what it is, though. It's the Freedom Train Podcast. I'm Joseph Ward. He's Patrick Irvin. That was Dr. Samori Swagger. Make sure you support him, support the documentary, and everything that he and the Source Radio Network got going on. But, yeah, Pat, go ahead and say power to the people.
To the people, be the power.
To the people, be the power. And then if you bathe at night, you should smell good. There you go. I like y'all.